glad you're here. We're starting, well, we're not starting, we're continuing in our series through Christology this morning, and we're going to just jump right into it because there's a lot to get to. So this morning, this is kind of where we've been, obviously, and so this morning we're going to be right here talking about Jesus's miracles a little bit, but also probably more in depth on the idea that Jesus is the Messiah, what that means and why it's important and how we can know that that's true. Because if you look, and I don't always like going to Wikipedia, but you can go there for some cool stuff. But if you go to Wikipedia and you look up people who've claimed that they're the Messiah, you're going to find quite a long list of people actually that have come out and publicly said, I'm the Messiah. So what does that mean, and what does it mean that we believe and that we know that Jesus is the Messiah, not just one, another one among the rest who've claimed such things? That's why I want to look at that. How do we know that Jesus is the Messiah, and what does that even mean? That's kind of what I want us to think through. If you've never thought through it before, I want us to think through it this morning, because it can help us not only understand Jesus' identity, but also it can help us understand the whole reason that we have the Bible at all. I think all of it will make sense. So I invite you to turn to your Bibles in John 20, or I have all the verses up on the screen if you want to pay attention there and just take down notes for later. But John chapter 20 is, of course, the end of John's Gospel, and then he has chapter 21, obviously. But John's Gospel, chapter 20, these two verses, I think, are so informative for us as believers of the church, but also as it concludes John's Gospel, helps us understand what he was doing in the first place when he was writing this Gospel. Notice what he says. John 20, verse 30, he says this. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples. And this kind of is almost alluding to what he says in the next chapter, where he's like, the world can't even contain how many things that Jesus did. I should have put that picture. I forgot the picture. There was this picture, and it shows like the Eiffel Tower, and it shows like the Statue of Liberty, and then it shows this big stack of papers, and it's like, these are all the things that Jesus did that John didn't include in his Gospel. Anyways, there's lots of signs, lots of things that Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, and he says, which are not written in this book. He didn't include them. But these are written, the ones that he's just been through for 19-odd chapters, are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And I think it's fascinating, as he says here, the Christ. He doesn't say that Jesus is, he doesn't talk about Jesus Christ as we often see it throughout scriptures. He calls him the Christ, definite article. And this is sort of, as perhaps many of you know, this is sort of John's thesis. It comes at the end of his gospel. He's proving that Jesus is the Christ, he's the Son of God, he's Yahweh in the flesh. That's why John has the most miracles out of all the Gospels. He's proving the fact that Jesus is deity, that's who he is. And as we've talked about before, he's deity and humanity perfectly in one person. But I think it's interesting that he gives them this label, the Christ. So in the terms of this definite article that he assigns to him, it's not that Jesus is one among many, he's the only one. And so let's look at those terms. Christ. Christ comes from this Greek word, Christos, which is essentially just a translation of the Hebrew word, Messiah, that you find in several places in the Old Testament. So that's where we get Christ from. Christ is the Greek transliteration, so to speak, of the Hebrew title, Messiah. And I think that's important, that Messiah or Christ, it's not a name, that Jesus Christ. Christ is not his last name, as you see it in the New Testament oftentimes. It's not like Jesus' last name, Christ. Christ is his title. He is the Christ, the only Christ, the only Messiah. That's what is being asserted throughout the New Testament. It essentially means anointed one or chosen one. He is an anointed one of God or a chosen one of God. That's who this figure is, and that we would believe that is Jesus himself. And you can see this sort of reference in several places in the New Testament. I'm going to take you just a couple. Notice here, Christ is, I forgot I had that name. Christ is a title and a name. Jesus the Christ. Matthew 16:16, Peter, he makes this confession. You are, notice, the Christ, the Son of the living God. When Jesus, who do you say that I am? And this is how Peter replies. And then this carries forward into the days of the apostles when they're forming the church in those really early days of the church. It says in Acts 5:42, and every day in the temple and from house to house, they did not cease teaching and preaching that the Christ is Jesus. Interesting phrasing, but I think it's so helpful to understand who Jesus is and how he is, how he is being perceived by those who believe in him. He is, Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one of God. Jesus is the Christ. Acts 18:5, when Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. So you could see there's a couple other places where that phrasing specifically appears. I think it appears in Acts 8 and some other places. But I think it's helpful. Jesus is the Christ. This is his title. This is the mission, so to speak, that he is fulfilling when he comes on earth. And this is alluded to in several other places. The other place I want to take you to is Daniel. Daniel chapter 9. This is a prophecy. This is at the latter portion of Daniel when he's getting into some prophetic literature. And we don't have time to go into all of the meanings of that, but just I want you to notice kind of this figure that's being prophesied in this particular passage. So Daniel writes, "This 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and mowed, but in a troubled time." That word there, anointed one, is the Hebrew word Messiah right there in the text. And it appears a couple times throughout the rest, of course, throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So we have this title, we have this identity of this person who would be the Christ, who would be the Messiah. And who is he? Well, if you look at the rest of the Old Testament, we know that he is this anticipated future ruler of Israel. That's sort of what Daniel is alluding to, that this Messiah, this anointed one would come, and we'll get into some other references in a minute, which more clearly identify that, but he is this one who is going to come and rule Israel perfectly. He's going to come and rule Israel mightily. He becomes the Christ, the Messiah becomes essentially the focus of all of Israelite culture and life, and we're going to get into that, but essentially if you look at those early days of the Hebrews when they were in the wilderness and their all of their life essentially was centered and revolved around the tabernacle. The tabernacle, as we're going to find out, is a place in which this promised Christ was sort of presented to them in symbolic form in a lot of ways. And it is them communing with the God who has made this promise to them, and they're cherishing and they're nurturing this promise, so to speak, in and amongst their people. So he's a future ruler, he's the focus of Israelite life, and his arrival, in fact, is promised all the way back in Eden. That's where this story, if you will, this promise, this idea of a Christ, of a Messiah, we are first given its glimpse. And of course, you perhaps know the verse I'm going to. It's Genesis 3:15, and I want you to notice again this very familiar passage. Because after the blunder in the garden, after that horrible decision that Adam and Eve make in Eden, after being tempted by the serpent, this is what God says to them. He makes this promise to Adam and Eve. And notice what he says. "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and I will, and between your offspring and her offspring, he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." This is often called the proto-evangelium, which is just a fancy word that means the first announcement of good news. And I think it's really fascinating, because if you go back here and look at what's happening, who is Jesus talking to, or who is God talking to in this particular passage?
Satan.
He's talking to Satan. So his promise to Adam and Eve, and I just get the picture, like he's like eyeballing the serpent, Adam and Eve are kind of in the background feeling all guilty and ashamed, and he's making a promise about them, directly threatening Satan. Directly telling Satan, you're going to be defeated, too bad for you, I'm standing up for these people, essentially. My creatures, my creation, the gem of my whole sort of speaking everything into existence, the highest sort of creatures, emblems of my creation that bear my image, they're the ones I'm making this promise about. So this promise of a offspring or a seed that would come from the woman and would crush the head of the serpent is being made as a threat to Satan, but it's a promise to Adam and Eve. And I think it's really interesting that that's how this beautiful first little piece of good news is found, in the fact that he's assuring Satan that no matter how many more people you deceive, that's what he means by your offspring, no matter. And by the way, this is why it's so controversial when Jesus, all the way in John chapter 8, and he's in that long interaction with the Pharisees, he basically alludes to the Pharisees as being the offspring of Satan. He's kind of referencing this. He's really throwing the Pharisees under the bus. But basically, what God is telling him, no matter how many more people you deceive, how many more offspring that you acquire, doesn't matter. My offspring, my seed, is going to come, and he's not going to just bruise your heel. He's going to crush your head. That's essentially what the phrasing means. That's what this promise means. And I think what is so fascinating about this is it comes right on the ground of where Adam and Eve messed up. He assures them that an offspring, a seed, would come and do this, put everything back together again. And this is the theme, I shouldn't have gone forward. This theme of offspring or seed is what is carried forward throughout many Old Testament passages. And it's what assures God's people that all of this mess that they've made, all of this horrible intrusion and invasion of sin and death and rebellion and darkness was not going to prevail forever. It prevailed in this moment. It ruined what God had created, and it resulted in Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden. But God's promise to them is that it wouldn't win in the long run, so to speak. And instead, he assures them that this one is going to come, and all of this wreckage, all of this ruin was going to be undone. And this is the promise. This right here is sort of the foundational sort of nucleus of what God's promise is to God's people, and it becomes sort of this defining hope around which they revolve their lives, and it gains more traction as you read through Genesis. If you read Genesis and you read Exodus and you read all of the, essentially read the Pentateuch, you'll find that this I shouldn't keep going forward, I keep wanting to. This idea of offspring or seed is carried forward through all of those books. Notice Genesis 13. This, of course, is God talking to Abram, and he's reassuring him of his promise. He first made it back in Genesis 12, but then in Genesis 13, he gives him a little bit more detail about it. And notice what he says. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land that you will see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring can also be counted. Arise and walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. Notice those words, offspring, repeated there multiple times. Again, alluding to this idea that there's going to be your offspring, your seed, are the ones of promise. If you flash forward all the way to the end of the life of Joseph, notice what he says here. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. There's this allusion to this coming generation in which Judah would be the one through which this seed is actually carried forth. So now we've gone through a really broad promise, and we're finding it more narrow, right? It's this broad promise of blessing to Abraham, a promise of blessing of a seed, and then it's a promise of blessing and promise through the line of Judah specifically. So we're gaining all, this is kind of what we could refer to as this unfolding revelation of God. God doesn't just vomit all of his promises onto Abraham and just expect him to catch up. No, he unfolds his promise according to his will, and he unfolds it gradually. He doesn't tell Abraham everything. He tells him exactly what he needs to know. And then as history moves forward, he reveals more and more of what this promise entails. And you can see that if you just look at Abram. You can see that if you look at the end of Genesis. And then we go all the way forward to this promise of the Messiah that's clearly made to David. And here, this is what's often called the Davidic Covenant, 2 Samuel 7. This is God talking to Nathan, and Nathan is supposed to go talk to David. But if you remember, David has wanted to build a temple. He wants to finally build God a house. And essentially, Nathan has to come and say, no, you're not going to be the one to do that. There's lots of reasons for that. But essentially, within this negative, within this no to David's desire to build God a permanent house where his people can worship him, he gives David a better promise. Notice what he says. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up, notice that word, your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. Who is he talking about right here?
Jesus.
And also Solomon. This is one of those passages where you have to understand it both. We've talked about this before. There's a historical meaning, but there's also a redemptive meaning. There's a historical meaning in which, literally, God is giving David a promise that the offspring that's going to come after you, he's going to be the one to build my house. And that's what happens. Solomon does that. David spends the rest of his days acquiring supplies, stockpiling assets. You can see that if you read 1 Chronicles. When David is given a no, I think it's really fascinating that he doesn't just like sit on his hands and throw himself a pity party. He actually gets to work and he starts amassing all kinds of resources in order for his son, the one who is being raised up after him, Solomon, to actually build the house as God intended. But also, the redemptive, the underlying meaning of this is that the offspring that's going to come after him, who is going to have a kingdom that lasts forever, it's not Solomon, as we all know. It's Jesus. It's the Messiah. It's the Christ. It's the one who would come. Yes, from your line, David, he's going to come this one who is going to put everything back together, and he's going to rule with perfect equity. He's going to rule with perfect justice and might and hope. So now we have here that, by the way, this is why, if you look at Isaiah chapter 11 or Jeremiah chapter 23, this is why the Messiah has this nickname as the shoot or the branch that will come from the stump of Jesse. It's because it's tied to David, the son of Jesse. That's kind of what that is referring to. So here we have now, in summary, who is the Christ? Well, he's God's anointed one from the tribe of Judah, as we've seen, and he's also in the Davidic line of kings, as we've just found out, from God himself, and he's going to rule with justice and with righteousness. This is who Israel's Messiah would be, and that's who they were hoping would arrive. This is what all of Israel's hope was revolving around, that Israel's Messiah was going to come and make things right. He was going to come and put all of these things back together. All of the horrible lineage of kings that, if you look in the history of the kings in 1st and 2nd Kings or 1st and 2nd Chronicles, all of that was going to be wiped away by this one who is going to come and rule perfectly and rule justly and rule forever. And this becomes, we're going to keep sweeping through lots of history. If you look at the rest of the Old Testament, this hope, this one that is clearly made to David, this offspring that's going to come, you can imagine as the kingdom is fracturing, as the kingdom is breaking apart. Israel is now separated into two nations, and they're warring, and they're having civil wars, and they're having constant conflicts outside. They're having constant turnover of king after king after king. What's being lost? The sense that God's going to do this. And that's why if you look at Kings, but Chronicles especially, if you look at Chronicles, that really tracks the line of the kings of Judah. The whole tenor of Chronicles is playing with this idea that this promise seems tenuous at best. It seems like hanging on by a thread over and over again, with every king constantly making horrible decisions. But yet through it all, if you look at it, what's being carried forward? It's always God assuring us that this promise will come true. Even in exile, when all of Israel had was just a shred of a hope, and this promise seemed all but lost, this is what they were clinging to. That's why the prophets of the exile are alluding to this. Isaiah, Jeremiah, they're saying, cling on to this. God still is going to work this out. God is still going to bring forth his anointed one, and he is going to make things right. And yet, if you keep going throughout history, as Israel was then released from captivity, you can kind of understand how the Messiah became only to be known through sort of military and political terms. Notice this passage, Psalm 2, a messianic psalm, an allusion to the Messiah, allusion to the Christ. And notice what it talks about. The kings of the earth, they set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, the same word, saying, let us burst their bonds and break in bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. This anointed one is seen as one who is going to come and overthrow tyranny. He was going to squash injustice. He was going to get rid. He was going to wipe out all of those horrible rulers, all of those kings that are laughing at God's people. This is what he was coming to do. And he was going to do it. Daniel 7 alludes to the same thing when he talks about this Ancient of Days, which is another sort of reference to the Messiah. He was going to come, everlasting dominion, you notice that, and his kingdom is not going to be destroyed because he's going to destroy everyone else's kingdom. So as you might imagine, for people who've been taken away from their homes, who've been tyrannized throughout all of their history, all of their heritage, that they've gone from oppression, to different conflict, to different conflict, you can imagine that this would be a really welcoming image. This would be an amazing message to cling to. That there was going to come one, an anointed one of God, and he was going to do away with all of these injustices. And this is how the predominant view of the Messiah, when you fast forward all the way to Jesus' day, what do they think he's going to be? They think he's going to be a charismatic leader with a lot of political wits and charisma, and he's going to lead Israel back to prominence. So you can see how this promised seed has gone from this one that God had promised would come and make things right, and through the course of history, it's devolved into what? That this one is going to come and be a military force, a political force to be reckoned with by whoever was the dominant kingdom of the time, and it happens to be in Jesus' time, Rome. This is the abiding hope of God's people in the time that Jesus arrives. The Messiah is just seen as, yes, there's lots of religious overtones, but the hope that he represents, the representative hope, sort of as a culture, is this military and political leader. So we have to ask this question. How does Jesus fit into that? Well, good political answer. He does and he doesn't. He doesn't really fit the mold, at least in terms of the first century ideas of whom the Messiah was, because he does fit the bill historically. He does fit the bill genetically, if you will. This is why, if you go to Matthew chapter 1, Matthew makes it very clear that Jesus is in the line of the Davidic kings. He ties him to David. He's in the line of Judah. So he ties him to both of those check marks, if you will. And he's saying, this is Jesus' heritage. You cannot mistake this. That's why Matthew is called the Gospel of the King, because it references him as the King, the coming one from God. And it shows us definitely that that is true. Son of David, tribe of Judah, all that. But what flustered the Pharisees, if you read the Gospels, why are they so flustered by Jesus in the first century? It's because even though there's all of these things, there's all these tick marks that seem to be, man, he's doing stuff that's like the Messiah, but then he's also doing things that are not Messiah-y things, at least in terms of how they were perceiving it. Because he's stirring up crowds, he's radically reinterpreting the law, he is hanging out with people that they were like, what are you doing? He's okay with embracing lepers, with reaching out to Samaritans. I mean, he's not following the law of Moses. How could he be this anointed one of God? How could he be this one who's going to do these things that we expect him to do? Overthrow Rome. He's from Nazareth. Nothing good comes from Nazareth. Who in the world would expect a military and political leader to come from ho-dunk town Nazareth? No one. So he is fitting the bill, but then also not at the same time. And yet, and this is why when you see Jesus' life, what is on display? Miracle after miracle, evidence after evidence, and he's showcasing to everyone, and he's not coming right out and saying it. He's more proving it by way of demonstration. And a good example of this is Isaiah 61. This is very much a messianic prophecy. It's from Isaiah, given to the people of Israel as they are coming out of exile. So he's giving them this message of just pure hope that the Spirit of the Lord is going to come on this one. And notice, he's going to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And on he goes, comfort, good news, hope to the poor, hope to the blind, relieving the deaf. And then we can keep going forward. If you go to, did I not have that in here? Oh, shoot, I forgot to copy it in here. Anyways, I'm not going to move on from this. So, the prophet Isaiah is making this prophecy regarding this one who is going to come. It's messianic. This is about the Christ. This is about the Messiah. And then, if you go, because I forgot to put it up here, if you go to Luke chapter 4, not by accident, of course, Jesus basically is like, yeah, all of that, this is me. And he says that quite demonstrably here in Luke 4. So he's just started his ministry. He is in Nazareth. He's in his hometown. And he's in the synagogue. Notice Luke 4:16. And he came up to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." I mean, talk about a mic drop. The mic drop of all time is that right there. He's going to this beautiful prophecy of the Messiah, something that has long defined the people of Israel, and it's sort of morphed over the ages, and yet now they find themselves here, and they're sitting in the synagogue, and this guy from Nazareth comes in and reads, and he says, yeah, that you've been expecting, here it is, it's here. And this is what Jesus goes on to show. You go back to Isaiah 29, he talks about the deaf. A prophecy of the Messiah, the deaf will hear the words of a book again, the blind will see. Isaiah 32:3, the eyes of those who see will not be closed, and the ears of those who hear will give attention. Notice Isaiah 35:6, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the lame shall leap, the deaf will have their ears unstopped. Over and over again, we have all of these things that are alluding to that when the Messiah comes, this is also going to come. When the Messiah arrives, these are the things that you're going to know about his arrival. This is what's going to happen. And so then we get to Matthew 4. And when he went through all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaimed the gospel of the kingdom, notice what's happening. healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan. This is what's happening. He's showing them. He's not coming out right and telling them, I'm the Messiah. He's showing them. Look at what's happening by my hand. Every single person that comes to him, he heals and he sets them right again. And wherever Jesus goes, he's being scrutinized, he's being surveilled by the Pharisees, he's being mobbed by beggars and by lepers, and the Pharisees, of course, are watching him to make sure what he's doing, seeing if he's ticking all the messianic boxes, so to speak. And of course, we would say that the religious officials had sort of misread what the Messiah was supposed to be. We're going to spend more time on that next week. But the point is that Jesus is clearly identifying himself as the Christ by what he is doing with those who come to him. These ones who are flocking to him. He's by healing them. And they're being proven by this testimony. This is why we have, he's turning water into wine. He causes a storm to be still. He gives blind their sight. He feeds a crowd of 5,000. He walks on water. He raises the dead back to life. This is all of Jesus' earthly ministry. All of these miracles that he's doing, they're not just humanitarian sort of end games or endeavors. He's not going around healing people just because he's nice. He's doing it to prove something, to show something. And that's the key point. It's not just that these miracles are happening because Jesus just wants to be a nice person. He's a humanitarian. He's doing it to show, I am the Christ. This is why if you go to Mark 2, and you know that's the story of the friends, and they start peeling off the roof, and they let their friend down, and Jesus heals them, and everyone gets mad. Why? Because what does Jesus say first to this guy?
Your sins are forgiven.
And the Pharisees are like, who does this guy think he is? He's blaspheming. Does he think he's God? Only God can forgive. And Jesus is like, what do you think's easier? To say he's forgiven or to say get up and walk? And to show you that I can do both with just a word, get up and walk. And he does. And he starts getting up and he leaps away. The point is, the miracles are always done in order to show who Jesus is. They're sort of the seals, the signs of approval of his identity as the Christ. He's the anointed one of God, the one who is going to, he's the seed that is going to crush the head of the serpent. That's what he's showing. That's what he's proving. He's the anointed one. And of course, as we're going to get into next week, all of that means a lot more than just, you know, fixing up wounds and being a better king. It necessitates death and resurrection. Because that's the true sort of nature of Jesus' ministry. All of the miracles that he does in the Gospels are essentially just preludes to the true and better miracle of his resurrection, which is the true sign of who he is, but also the true purpose of why he came. All of those other ones, they're just sort of teasers to the big one, so to speak, to the ultimate reason why he came. We're going to get into that next week. So anyways, that was a really fast, really bird's eye introduction and overview of the Messiah and the Christ and how Jesus is the fulfiller of all of that. So I pray that blesses you. Who has questions or thoughts if you were able to keep up with all of that? Who has anything that you were thinking of? Yes.
I'm glad you hit that list right there, because I've been like working in the miracles. You know, I've just been looking at that particular John, and I started to look through, and I first got latched onto how they progress in like, you know, grandiosity.
Sure.
He starts with like he doesn't even want to do the wine thing. He's like, well, I'm not really about that, you know, but okay, I'll square this away for you. Boom, makes the wine for the wedding party, and then it ends with, and John, he's commanding death to leave his friend. It's like, whew,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you go into the garden where, you know, Malchus gets his ear cut off. And I'm like, that's weird. John, he mentions the guy's name, but he doesn't talk about healing him. And I'm like, what's up with that? But then you talked about the deaf part. And I was like, everything has a purpose that he does. And he's like restoring the hearing. And this is the high priest's servant. Yeah. So it's like got humongous other implications to it. Right? So I just wanted to, you know, say thanks for bringing that up. Because that kind of made a connection with me right now. And then the other thing was, you know, you talk about how the Pharisees are like expecting this warrior prince, you know, and they're like really latched onto that because they've been oppressed for so long. And then they see Jesus come, you know, like a lamb. And it's like, it really must have blown their minds because he's saying, hey, you know, you got to obey your masters. They were put over you. So he was like the anti of what they were expecting. That's like enslaved, because he even said, yeah, pay the tax. Whose face is on that coin? Give it to Caesar.
That's a
and
great
so that was like, that was totally blowing their minds. Yeah. You know, because they were the den of vipers.
Yeah.
It's like, you got to really drill into
that passage where he's, you know, render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's. That's a great passage in terms of identifying like the disparity between what they were expecting the Messiah to do and then what he actually does, because he kind of just cuts through their little game that they're trying to play with him. He's just like, you know,
I could like just picture them standing there like just blinking. What is this dude talking about?
Well, that's what speechless quite often.
Yeah. Because he's doing the miracles that they can't deny either, so they're like perplexed.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's my thoughts on that. It's pretty good.
Anyone else with... Yeah, Eric.
So how the disciples themselves, even Peter, wanted to stop Jesus from being killed. And again, how you're talking about how, like, they didn't understand how he didn't fit the bill. He was supposed to be... They all thought he was going to be a political leader. It's why some people probably turned on him after Palm Sunday, or, you know, they're so excited that he's riding in, like, cool, he's going to defeat them.
Happening.
Yeah, and then he dies, and they're like, what? Yeah. What just happened?
Like, total buzz.
Yeah, it's crazy, but I it really blew my mind. It was said to me, I forget which theologian said this, but basically, they call it the two distant mountains. So, like, when you're driving down the highway, especially out west, you can see all the mountains. You're like, wow, they're so pretty together. Mm-hmm. If you got up to that mountain, the other one might be 30 miles still in the distance, and that's what was happening, both in his... first ministry, and all, like the second part is there's going to be that judgment. He will be that powerful leader they saw, but they couldn't separate the two. And even you put up Isaiah 61, he stops. And if you read the next line, it mentions the day of vengeance of the Lord.
Yeah.
And they could even ask, well, why did he stop halfway through? Almost illustrating, like, hey, that's the second part of the mountain. And I think we'll get into eschatology later, but I think the same thing happens with some of my friends in eschatology. They'll try to merge, you know, him coming to get us in the clouds and his second coming all together. And I try to tell them that it's kind of a two-distant mountain thing again.
Yeah.
Where sometimes it's written in the same verse that he's going to come get us and then he's going to do this, but it's really that two-distant mountain thing.
Right.
And you have to read things in context, because if you read one of these verses, it's like, oh, he's going to do all this all at once. It's like that's why the scripture's all over, and he plants it all over the place. And it had to be a mystery in the Old Testament. So, you know, Satan didn't know, because had he known, he wouldn't have him killed on the cross. So it's just really cool how God's, once you look back, it's like, this is genius. Like, who would have thought of this? This is great.
Because Satan doesn't have omniscience.
Exactly.
So he can read the Bible, but he's, you know, and that's what I tell people too. They're like, you know, when you witness to somebody and they're like, well, this guy, you know, they killed him. So what, you know, because they're not getting the resurrection. Plus, look, man. You know, everybody's going to bow the knee in this life or the next. It's going to happen. So it's just like, wait and see. You know, it's that other half. And I like that.
Yeah.
What you talked about the mountains, because I've experienced that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's not far. I'll get over there. And then you get there and it's like, wow, that's way
out there. I can like imagine Jesus like on the cross, like when he, you know, starts reciting Psalms 22. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? Like, Satan's eyes getting big, like, uh-oh. Like, this is what it said would happen.
Yep.
Like, I screwed up. It's too late. It's too late.
Yep.
Any other thoughts? Anything else that came to mind?
When you were talking about Jesus healing the blind, just reminds me of being born again and having new sight, which...
Yeah.
You know, along with all of that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Mark A is a good example of that, where he healed the guy. But it's like, it takes the two stages, if you remember that. Like, at first he sees men, and they're like trees walking, and then he lays hands on them again, that he sees clearly. It's a good representation of the process of salvation, because the first sort of sign of healing of that guy, it's like, people are seeing Jesus, but not for who he truly is. And then the second healing, he heals the guy, and it's like, oh, we can finally see who Jesus is and who he truly is and who he's meant to be. But I think that's a great image. The blind receiving their sight is a great image of salvation, for sure.
I think Paul's story is like the archetypical getting witness to and then having your sight restored. You know,
yeah.
just that whole that how that whole thing happens is like played out, you know,
by
Christians talking to people, and then boom, they get their sight. And I think it's really unique because it's happening to Paul,
you know?
And then his role then later. It's pretty cool how that plays out.
All right, well, very good. We'll stop there. We'll pick up next week.